Welcome to episode 8 of Alternate Realities, the podcast series where we literally talk about alternate realities, different perspectives on life. My guest today is the very inspiring Jill Castle. We're going to be talking about birth trauma. It's not an easy subject to talk about, and I think certainly when I first became a mother, going on for 43 years ago now, it was something that really wasn't discussed. We found a partner, got married, had children, and the more unsavory side of childbirth was just not discussed. It was a taboo subject, and everything that went with it was. I'm hoping that you're going to find today's conversation both informative and also inspirational, in that we may go through traumas in life, but it's actually what we do with that experience afterwards that really counts. So a very warm welcome to Jill this afternoon. Thank you for coming on Alternate Realities, Jill. I think we've got a very interesting conversation coming up, so it's really good to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm really excited and really pleased, actually, that you've thought to ask me along for a chat. So thank you.
Well, your story is quite amazing. And I think since we last spoke, it's got even more amazing. So we'll talk about that in a bit. I'd like to start off by talking about, obviously you're married and you've got a young son. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself before all these other things happened to you?
Yes. So I live in the north of England, and I'm not sure where you want me to start from, but basically I left school and did a gap year, travelled about in South America and South Africa, went off to a variety of places. I did some teaching in Lesotho, which is a very small country in South Africa. I went there, can I just say, before Prince Harry made it famous. So I like to think that he followed me.
Well, it sounds like he did, but it also sounds like you have always had a spirit for adventure by the sound of it.
Well, I certainly have. Itchy feet, I think they call it. When I did my gap year in 1998, hardly anybody else. I think I was actually the only person in my year to do a gap year. It was kind of unheard of at the time. They're much more popular now, of course. So I went off and I did that, and I came home, and ultimately I ended up doing a degree in law at the University of Leeds, which suited my personality in terms of the analytical side, I suppose, and the debating side, but I didn't really relish being in an office. I'm not really an office sort of girl. So I didn't really go down that route professionally. I sort of messed about, if you like. I spent my 20s drinking far too much, doing things I shouldn't be doing, partying. I was all a bit lost, really, until I got to the age of 27. And then I decided that I would finally apply to join the police. Now, I don't know if anybody remembers Juliet Bravo. I grew up in the 1980s, and she was a huge heroine of mine from the television. She was a policewoman on the television in the 1980s, obviously a fictional character. And I'd always wanted to join the police ever since being a young girl. But typical of myself, I didn't have the confidence to apply. I didn't think I'd get in. Didn't think I'd pass the myriad of tests that you have to do in order to join the police. So anyway, I got to the age of 27 and thought, you know, I really need to start making something of my life. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Applied for the police in West Yorkshire. And after 2 long years, I finally got in after I passed all the tests. And my husband and I moved down to West Yorkshire. And that's where I was.
So, yes, I do remember Juliet Bravo, but I'm kind of old enough to actually remember Dixon of Dock Green as well.
Right.
And Zed Cars. I think it's very interesting, actually. It's kind of like the way society has moved on, isn't it? You know, that it was Zed Cars and it was Dixon of Dock Green and all those kind of programmes back then. And then kind of now there's Vera and, you know, there's women. Really coming out in those police programs now. So, you know, that was obviously a role model that you were looking to. And how did it feel then when you passed and you got in? And, you know, after thinking that you felt, could do it.
Oh, it felt amazing. I mean, it's pretty difficult to get in. There are a lot of things that you have to go through. You know, you have your medical, you have what they call the carousel, which is awful. That's a whole day of role plays and interviews and tests. The interview itself actually is completely bizarre, like no other interview I've had before or after. So what they do for the police interviews is they have an actor in the room that asks a set number of questions. They're all exactly the same questions, and you're given exactly 5 minutes to answer the question. And it starts with a buzzer, and the actor will ask you a question. They won't give any response to your answer, so you don't get anything back. You don't get any sort of nodding, smiling, shaking of head, nothing. They just sit there and they look at you. And you have to keep talking until the buzzer. Or if you stop talking, you just sit there in complete silence until the buzzer goes, and then they ask the next question. So it's very, very surreal, because normally with an interview, you get a bit of feedback. So
yeah,
so that was actually really, really difficult, especially for somebody like me. I feed off body language. I feed off, well, communicating with people like we are now, having a conversation. Yeah. So that was difficult. And then, of course, you've got your physical that you have to do as well. And yeah, I mean, it took 2 long years. So I was ecstatic when I finally got in. Really pleased.
So what year was it then when you finally passed and you actually started that journey of being a police officer?
2009, February 2009. So we'd moved down to West Yorkshire from Northumberland at the Christmas time. And I started at the very beginning of February. I think it was the 2nd of February 2009 that I started. So I had, I think it was 16 weeks at police training school, which are still the best 16 weeks of my entire life. I absolutely loved it. I really felt like I'd found my tribe. I was among very like-minded people. We were all people that didn't like to be in an office. We were all people that liked adventure, people that wanted to help other people. And you know, I was really attracted to the fact that no day was going to be the same. So yeah, I really found like I'd found my family, if you like, my work family. And that's the thing with the police, a bit like being in the forces, is it's not just a job, it's a whole identity, and you are called the police family. And when you're in the job, that's what you call it. You just call it the job, which I don't really think you get with other sort of careers, apart from the forces, of course.
I think that's something that, you know, we don't realize. I mean, obviously I do, because I've been in that sort of family in the forces. But I think, you know, for most people, I've also know a few ex-police officers, so you know, you kind of get that camaraderie and you get that thing. But I think you know, the general public don't always get that, and they don't see how much goes into what you have to do as part of that job. It's not all about just catching the bad guys, is it?
No, exactly. And it very much is, we look after each other. You know, everyone has each other's backs. And you know, we've got a thing in the police, if we've got an officer down, it's a code zero. So you press the red button on your radio, it's code zero. There's a special alarm that goes out onto everybody's radios, and everybody literally drops everything that they're doing. And you know, they make their way over there to help the officer that's down. And it I always found it really emotional, actually, when a code zero went off, just the way that everybody, you know, well, just did literally just drop everything to go and support one of their colleagues. It just reinforced the whole fact that what we were in was something special and something unique. And it stays with you. Once you're in the force, once you're in the job, you know.
Well, it's very much like that, as you know, in the forces. And coming to that, you know, I believe your husband was actually serving.
Yes, he was.
Before you met. So,
yes. Yeah. He joined the Marines when he was only 17 years old. So he was really young when he joined the Marines. again, like me, he doesn't like being told that he can't do something. So he joined the Marines when he was 17, and he had 7 years in 4-5 commando. But like I say, this was actually before I met him. And he's always understood what the police meant to me, because he, like we've just discussed, he's from the forces background. His dad was in the RAF for however many years. His brother was in the parachute regiment. So he's all, you know, very much a military background. So he understands that sort of family atmosphere, if you like, of being in the forces. I mean, when he did his final 30 miler, he actually did it twice, because the first time he did it, he had a stress fracture on his foot, which I think he stumbled about 2 miles in, broke his foot, but continued and finished it. But when they got to the end, the guy that had been directing them at the front had taken them slightly the wrong way. So they were told, you know, you've got to do it again tomorrow. And I remember Chris, my husband, saying, you know, I've never seen so many fully grown men cry. Said, you know, just the idea. So he did it twice. So we feed off each other, I suppose. We're both very similar in that way, you know, we're pretty resilient. And I often think of him doing that 30 miler twice with a broken foot when I'm trying to do my crazy things.
I've heard that story more than once in different ways over the years, and I don't, you know, I think, you know, when you've got that determination to pass that training, you know, you get on with it, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you guys met after he'd left the Marines, and when did you actually get married?
We got married in, now I'm going to get in trouble here if I get the date wrong. We got married in 2007. Ironically, he remembered our first anniversary and I forgot it. So I haven't been allowed to forget that.
Romantic of you, Jim.
He's actually really good. I'm terrible. So yeah, we married in 2007. So we've been together since 2002. I was only 22 when I met him and he was 25. So we've been together nearly 19 years now. So we always laugh that he only had 2 weeks of freedom after he left the Marines before I met him.
So you've got married and you started married life, and you know, life's moving forward, and you've got this history behind you of being adventurous and just living life to the max by the sounds of things. But then something happened, didn't it, when you had your son?
Yes. So I fell pregnant in early 2011. When I got pregnant, I was really, really, really lucky when I was on my 2-year probation in the police. I got on very well with my inspector, and he sort of identified that I was somebody with potential. So it was pretty much unheard of, but I was offered a position to work on the vice team. And they're the team that work with the prostitutes. And I quite liked working on that team because it was more proactive. You were actively trying to help the prostitutes, the working women, to get off the streets. You're trying to work out why they were there in the first place. So I was actually working there when I fell pregnant. And anyway, once you're pregnant in the police, you go off the front line. And I had an absolutely horrifically boring job, stuck in an office in the customer satisfaction unit, which is as bad as it sounds. And so I was there for a good few months. And then one morning, when I was 34 weeks pregnant, I was woken up with a sharp pain. Didn't realise, because it was my first baby, that I was actually in the early stages of labour. And so off we went to the hospital just to get checked out. And that was the start of it all, really. That was the start of my early labour with my baby, Sam. He was born later that night. He was only 4 pounds 7. So because he was so small, normally when babies are born, they help themselves out of the birthing canal. They effectively sort of can pull themselves out. But because he was only 4 pounds 7, he was really, really, he was too small. He got weak, so his heart rate fell. And it all got a bit panic stationed. So they had to whip him out really quickly using forceps. Luckily, I had an epidural, even though that took 3 attempts to get in. They did eventually manage to get the epidural in. And in so doing, they saved his life. But I was really, really badly damaged in the process. I sustained what we call a fourth degree tear, which the easiest way to describe that really is you split in two. So that's going all the way from the vagina, all the way through the sphincter and the anus, and you're completely split in two. Now, this would have been all well and good, and people do suffer fourth degree tears, but vast majority of women who suffer these tears are repaired properly at the time. But unfortunately for me, the consultant who was stitching up my wounds, she thought I'd suffered a second degree tear. So she stitched me up, thinking that that's what she was dealing with. Then she thought, oh no, I've made a mistake here. It's a third degree tear. So she took out all the stitches and stitched me back up again and sent me on my way to the ward. And this is actually really critical to what eventually happened. This error, this constant restitching of the wound area. So I went off onto the ward with my little baby, who was tube fed, bless his little soul, Sam, because he was so tiny. And I just didn't have the breast milk. You know, I think my body was just completely traumatized by the early labor. It just wasn't ready to provide milk. And so, of course, he had to be fed in some way. So he was tube fed. Anyway, after a couple of days of being on the ward with Sam, I was, of course, in a lot of discomfort after being torn so badly, but it was just getting beyond manageable. Now, I'm a pretty tough person, and I don't really like to make a fuss. I'm quite British like that. You know, the way that I was brought up is, well, you just get on with it. Come on. Just put your head down and get on with it. Don't make
a mess. But can I just interject there, Jill?
Because
so, you know, is this still 2011?
Yeah, this is October 2011.
Okay, so I had my first child back in 1977. Mm-hmm. Sorry, 78. I was got pregnant in 77. Had her in the summer of 78, and. You know, one of the things that I listen to when I'm speaking to women, even now, and, you know, I've kind of watched people have children in recent years, is mm-hmm. that there is this, and it was there, well, you didn't say anything, you know, you husbands were barely allowed to even come anywhere near you, let alone be there mm-hmm. and hold your hand back in, you know, in the 70s.
Yeah.
But there is, and there always has been, a certain attitude that I think people have towards childbirth. And when it does go well, it goes incredibly well, doesn't it? So, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, that you should get pregnant, you should have your pregnancy, and you should have the baby. And it's just something that the woman just kind of knows what to do with her own body, and everything's hunky-dory. And mm-hmm. it isn't like that. Because before we set this interview up, I was looking at the figures are something like 30,000 women yeah. suffer birth trauma. And yeah, we're talking about these days. We're talking yeah. about in current times there, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
And I know when I had the opposite problem to you in the sense that my daughter was 3 weeks and 2 days late.
That's late.
And unfortunately, back in the 70s, I was actually in a military hospital. I was in Berlin. So by the time I realised that nobody was listening to me, you know, I was in a situation where I couldn't fly anywhere, I couldn't go anywhere else, and I couldn't get an access to a German hospital. So I was stuck with the consultant that I had. And, mm-hmm. you know, I knew this baby was well overdue because I was very slim at the time. And, you know, having been pregnant at 20 weeks, you can grab hold of a little foot.
Yeah.
So if, you know, there's a little person inside of you by 20 yeah. weeks. So, you know, them telling me that I got my dates wrong was ridiculous, because that would have meant I was throwing up before I was pregnant, and at 20 mm-hmm. weeks I wouldn't have been able to grab this little foot. And it's so hard, because also back then, unless there was a problem, there were no ultrasounds. You just didn't have one at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah.
they relied so much on, you know, and then there's this kind of stiff upper lip thing, isn't there, that you should be fine, you know, when it all happens. And I'll come back to that in a minute. You know, I want you to carry on your story. But, you know, then when things go horribly wrong, it's very traumatic.
It is. And I think the most traumatic thing about it for me personally is how vulnerable you are. And just like you've touched on, when people don't listen to you. And yeah. You know that they must listen to you because you need their help and you can't do this on your own. And it's a very, very frightening position to be in when you know things are not right and you're telling medical professionals that things are not right and you need their help and you get ignored. And that's what happened to me. So after a couple of days, like I said, the pain was becoming unmanageable and I started to almost lose the plot, really. I had brown discharge in my underwear. And I remember thinking, well, that's not right. You know, after a couple of days, that's not, what is that? Where's that coming from?
Yeah.
And I said to the midwife, you know, I've got this brown discharge on my underwear. The tear is really, really painful. And this was the phrase that was repeated to me constantly. The pain is just the tissues knitting back together. It's a good sign. They're just knitting back together. They're doing their job. And the brown discharge, that'll just be, you know, that's just excess from, you know, discharge from around the wound or something equally as vague. And I was sort of thinking, right, okay, tissues are knitting together. Yeah.
So did anybody actually examine you at this stage, or were they just telling you this?
They were just telling me at this point. They did keep taking my temperature, which kept coming back as normal. But if you look at the photographs of me back at that time, those exact days, I mean, I was almost purple. I was bright red, and I remember being unbelievably hot all the time. And then, it just progressed over the next couple of days. I was having a shower and then I realised that there was poo everywhere. And I just couldn't work out where it was coming from. And I remember being in the shower, extremely distressed, and a midwife or somebody came along to see why I was so distressed. And I mean, this sounds horrific. You have no dignity when you've had a baby. And I remember turning around in the shower and saying, where is my bottom? Where is it? I don't understand. Where's it gone? Where is this poo coming from? I can't work out what's happening to my body. She's like, oh, you're fine. You know, this is normal. You know, this is fine. You've got a really bad tear and just keep yourself clean. But I remember distinctly being in that shower and just thinking, I don't know what's happened to my body. And nobody's listening to me saying that this is going horribly wrong.
So at this point, was this midwife still not examining you?
No, I still wasn't examined. The following day I was examined and they just said, yeah, no, it looks all right. You know, it's pretty hot, but, you know, it's the tissues knitting together, that old thing. But then it all started escalating and I remember going to the toilet and then pulling the emergency buzzer because I was in just so much unbelievable pain going to the toilet and passing a bowel movement. And again, I could tell from their faces that they couldn't understand why I was so distressed. And I was getting more distressed because I could see that they couldn't understand why I was distressed. So, you know, it was all just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
And that's the hard thing, isn't it, Jill? When you're in a situation like that, that it's so terribly hard when you know that something's terribly wrong.
Yeah.
And you show distress because of that. And then... Yeah. Because you're not getting listened to, you get even more distressed because you know there's something terribly wrong and nobody's really taking it seriously.
Yeah. And also, they don't know you as a person. And I was trying to say, but I'm not normally like this. You know, normally I'm one of these people, I just get on with things. You know, I don't make a fuss. This is not normal for me to be like this. And then the crunch came when I was walking down the corridor, but I mean, I say walking, dragging myself along the corridor, holding onto the wall. And I just sort of stopped and I was on the verge of collapsing. And this male midwife came along the corridor and he said, you know, are you all right? And I just said, no, I can't cope. I can't cope any longer. You know, there's something badly wrong. It's getting more and more painful. I can't work out where my bottom is. I don't understand what's happening. And he said the lines, which I've never forgotten. Well, maybe it's just your perception of the pain. So basically, obviously, honestly, at that moment, like something in me just died, and I thought, oh my God, what?
So this is actually a man cannot give birth himself,
exactly.
Telling you what your perception of post-child birth pain is.
Yeah. So he then said, oh, would you like me to examine you? But I was livid. I was furious. And I just said, no, thank you. I'm fine. Don't want anyone examining me. I'm absolutely fine. And staggered off to my bed.
So was that a reaction then? Because you are, you know, you and I seem to have quite similar characters in the, you know, get on with it and do it. And very strong, very resilient. You're obviously very resilient. But was that a reaction to what he said, that you almost kind of were talking yourself into being okay?
No, I don't think it was more, what's the word? Not embarrassed, but I felt belittled.
Right.
You know, that I was just being silly. And I just thought, oh, that's fine. I don't want to be anywhere near you. You stupid man. You have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. And I just wanted to get away from him, quite frankly. And by this point, you know, I'd mentioned to a midwife that I had feces in my underwear and I was obviously incontinent. And again, it was just a look of like, oh, right, that's not right. But still, like, nothing was happening. And then the midwife must have realised, the male midwife must have realised, you know, something's not quite right. And they must have had a discussion somewhere that they were starting to put two and two together. So a lovely midwife finally offered to examine me. And she said that she literally only got her finger near the wound. And she said, and you nearly jumped off the bed. And she said, you know, you are obviously, and that's when they started to go, oh, right, hang on. So they brought down senior people to come and examine me. And this shows you how much pain I was in. They actually had to give me gas and air in order to examine me.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting on the bed with the midwife holding my hand as they examined me. And that's when they sort of went, right, yeah, you've got a fourth degree tear. By this point, I had a huge abscess. It was like the size of a golf ball or something.
And how many days had gone by for that abscess to have formed?
5 days. So, but obviously it was filled with feces.
So, of course.
That's what I mean. That's when all hell broke loose, basically. I think they thought, bloody hell, what have we missed here?
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I had the same, I mean, not in the sense of what happened, but I had the same thing, is that they were treating me like I was hysterical, which I wasn't. I mean, I'm not a hysterical kind of person. But I just kept saying, you know, this isn't right, because every week when I got to near my due date, they had said, well, we can't agree the dates. So we'll kind of deliver you if you go 2 weeks late, because that way either you'll be 38 weeks or 42 weeks, either which will be safe. And every week they send me home, and every week I would be. And at that point, my husband was actually, we were stationed in Berlin, so he actually was coming home every night. And I was sobbing, you know, going home every week saying, they're not going to, I'm going to be pregnant forever. And, you know, because I was scared and nobody was listening to me.
Yeah.
And so when it got to 3 weeks late, you know, they still sent me home and they said, Their actual words were, "You're still putting on weight, so you can't be ready." Well, I was blowing up with fluid by that time. So, you know, I mean, yeah. That would...
So dangerous.
Yeah, very, very dangerous. Yeah. And so, of course, when I finally did go into labour, it wasn't dramatic. The labour itself, the contractions were very close. They were every 2 minutes, but it wasn't really painful to start with. So this is, again, you'll relate to this because you're obviously, you know, that adventurous person as too. I went to the hospital on the bus.
Yeah.
Went down on the bus because I wasn't in excruciating pain. I, you know, got there and went through all the process of checking me and yes, you're in labour, and they were still. And well, of course, because I was so overdue, what tends to happen when you're that overdue is what they call it past your sell-by date. When you mm-hmm. start hard contractions, the placenta will abrupt.
Yeah,
it's one of the most common causes for a placental abruption. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I didn't know. I mean, you know, there was a problem with the, the machine, you know, the actual monitor for the baby's heartbeat. So they had ran off to get another one. And within a very short space of time, all hell broke loose because unbeknownst to me, I was hemorrhaging because the placenta had abrupted. And, you know, so this is something that I really relate to as you're telling this story, because, you know, you go from people not taking you seriously to all hell breaking loose in the space of a few minutes. You know, for me, it was that much of an emergency. And I'll never forget the look on the consultant's face. You know, his cockiness had gone when he actually walked through the door because he sort of looked horrified at all this hemorrhaging. And it was so much of an emergency. The two things that stick out in my mind even today is that they were knocking me out as the lift doors were open. That's how fast they had to work.
Yeah.
And two, they actually said to my husband, "We'll do what we can." So he actually didn't know whether he was going to see me or his child. Yeah. And at that point, we didn't know what I was having anyway. So he didn't think either one of us were coming out of that operating theatre alive. It was terrifying for the man. And he was a hardened paratrooper. So for him to admit that he was terrified, you can imagine the scene, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's very difficult for the men. Very difficult.
Yeah, and there is this kind of thing, isn't it? You know, that all of a sudden everybody's taking, they've gone from treating you like you're, you know, making a big fuss about nothing to, oh my gosh, we've really got a problem here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Obviously, that, you know, the looks that were going between them. And then, of course, that's when they had the discussion straight away of what are we going to do about this? What we need to fix this, we need to do something, we need to stop all of the feces getting into the infection.
Yeah.
And that's when the first conversation about having a stoma, having a colostomy came up. Now,
did you at that stage know what a colostomy was?
Well, I knew what an ileostomy was, which is slightly different.
Yeah.
Same thing, it's a stoma. Only because somebody I'd met in that year had one. But she had it. The normal reason that most people have it is because she's got Crohn's and colitis.
Yeah.
But she'd had a really, really bad experience with hers, and you know, but hers was more planned, if you like. But she found the whole thing just horrific and really undignified and very distressing. But she ultimately got hers reversed. But when they were telling me, you know, so we think stoma might be the way forward, only temporarily, so that we can divert the feces from the wound site, from the infection site, give it a chance to clear up, and then we can repair you, reverse the stoma, and off you go on your way. Now, when they were telling me this, I was in so much pain. I didn't really care. in my head, I was thinking, right, I remember when my friend had this and it was just horrific and she didn't go out and it was just awful and she cried all the time and that's what I'm potentially facing. But I was like, yeah, but it's going to fix my infection and then they can repair me. And oh, it should only be for 12 weeks. So yeah, I don't care. Let's do it. having said that, when they left the room, I'll never forget that the midwife who was there, and obviously I burst into tears, and I remember her just hugging me and just saying, just let it all out, let it all out, just let it all out. And I did, my did I, sobbing and sobbing. And then I had to go back onto the ward to get my stuff, because they had eventually decided that I would get a private room. And I remember the door opening onto the ward, and I remember just thinking, right, this is the next chapter. You know, this is a massive thing that I'm just about to undergo. And I remember walking down the ward past all the other women with their babies, just thinking, yeah, I'm about to go on a much more difficult journey than you. Yeah, this is different. And poor Chris, he just literally nipped down for coffee, so he'd missed the whole thing. And he came back to find me and a midwife and somebody else. I was just bursting into tears every now and then, trying to pack up all my things to go into the separate room. And and I always remember his face just totally ashen, actually, just thinking, right, my wife is really, you know, she's really poorly and she's going to have a major operation. It was, it was a defining moment, shall we say.
It's so frightening for them, isn't it? Because, you know, even though we're in an age now where, you know, we have a lot more independence as women, and things are very, very different from when I got married over 40 years ago. But, you know, nevertheless, a man still wants to feel protective towards his wife. You know, he wants to care and love her. And, you know, you're in a situation when something like this happens where they literally can't do anything but stand there and watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, similarly, for my poor mum, and my parents came down, and over the preceding 2 years, probably, my poor mum, she lost a lot of weight, found the whole thing very distressing, because she also knew, because she'd had two lovely births, all absolutely fine, and I think it really upset her to know what I'd missed out on. You know, not only because I was really ill and had lots of operations and things, but, you know, I'd had the bonding with my baby taken away. You know, it was all just very, very distressing for everybody. And I think this is the thing about traumatic births. It's not just the mother that suffers. It's the partner. It's the family. It's the grandparents. And it's the bond with a mother and baby that can suffer as well. So it's a real ripple effect that happens when you have a traumatic birth. I think a lot of people don't appreciate.
They don't, because it's supposed to be one of the most natural things in the world. It's supposed to be a joyous time, and it is for many, many women. But when it goes wrong, it is very traumatic. And I know, you know, for me, being over in Berlin, I had no family, and nobody there to help. I was sent home, you know, 9 days after the delivery, and I remember coming home, and the following morning my husband went to work at 7 o'clock in the morning and didn't come home until 10:30 that night. You know, and there you are, you've just had major surgery and you're completely traumatized by what's happened to you.
Well, I mean, it was similar with us, really, because we lived in Leeds, so we were 150 miles away from home. Chris is a commercial diver now, so he goes away for weeks at a time. And the job that he had at that time meant he was going away for a month at a time. Now, after you've had stoma surgery, it's a little bit like the restrictions you have when you have a C-section. So you can't drive, you can't lift things, but it's even more serious about lifting things. You have to be extremely careful about what you're doing with your stomach. So we were home for about a week, I think, and he had to go back to work. He had to go back offshore. So there I was, potentially going to be completely on my own in Leeds with a tiny little premature baby and no car and no support. So my mum
So down. can I just clarify that bit for people? Because for some listeners, I mean, the listeners that are in the same situation as you and I that have actually got stomas, they will kind of know what you're talking about, or some of them will. But I'd like to clarify that, because I don't know if you've seen it, but I did a fitness video. I'm very, very vocal about hernia prevention. And it's something that I feel very strongly about. And I think, you know, for those people who have, you know, maybe a major organ taken out, such as the large colon, but they've had it done by keyhole surgery, there's a massive difference between that and a full laparotomy. And so you're talking about having the full laparotomy, aren't you?
I think the
midline one.
No, I didn't. No, I had keyhole.
Okay.
I had keyhole, which is again, I mean, I just think I'm very lucky. No, I had that, but they put, like you mentioned hernias, you see, they put the fear of God into me about getting a hernia.
You see, that Jill, in itself is unusual, because I've spoken to so many people in the last 7 years since I had my surgery, and I did have the full midline laparotomy for mine.
Yeah, well, my friend did. And that's what I was terrified about as well.
That's something that obviously is very different. And that was a wrong assumption of mine, that when you said about being careful, that's kind of really good, in the sense that they did give you all those warnings, because
I see
lots of things online with people, you know, kind of doing exercise and whatever, and it's a very different thing depending on what kind of surgery you've had as to when you can get back to it and how quickly you can start doing things. When you've got a stoma, you've got, you know, in effect a hole through your abdominal wall that is there, and so you're always at risk. That's the thing.
The problem I also had, you see, is obviously I just had a baby, so my stomach muscles were gone to shot anyway, so I was really overweight because I just had a baby. My stomach muscles were already shot, then I had the stoma. I was completely paranoid about getting a hernia. I mean, it obsessed me for about 4 years, because when you've had surgeries, especially emergency surgeries, you'll do anything to avoid any future surgeries. So I was just
not really much fun, is it?
No, exactly. So yeah, but I mean, I did have heavy things to lift, you know. I had the baby in his carrier, and I had the buggy, and I had, you know, I did have a lot of things that I needed to be able to lift, but I couldn't. So my mum came down for 3 weeks, and so she was my chauffeur, bless her heart, and she did everything really, including fighting on my behalf with the GP to get antibiotics and all this sort of thing, because I was riven with urine infections and things like that afterwards. But that added on to the immense stress of what I then went through, because I didn't have my family around me. So during the birth, I'd also sustained what we call a rectovaginal fistula. Now, that's when you've got a hole between the rectum, the wall, and the vagina, which is also how feces were coming out through my vagina. That's why when I was in the hospital, I couldn't work out where my bottom was, because feces was coming out of my vagina as well. So this is part of the reason why I was so distressed, and I couldn't work out what was happening with my body. And I'd never even heard of a rectovaginal fistula, which, to be fair, most people haven't.
Because you don't kind of, it's like most things in life, isn't it? Until you actually have to deal with it, why would you need to know about it?
Yeah, exactly. So my fistula was septic. It was a septic tract. And I had that septic tract for a year. And what would happen was, if I tried to walk or do anything quickly, the heat that would be in my underwear, if you like, would exacerbate the septic tract, and I would get a rampant infection. You know, it would just explode in my body. So I was essentially on metronidazole, which is an extremely powerful antibiotic. I was on that for a year, basically. I had to go in and out of hospital quite a few times on an emergency admission to get this septic tract drained, because it had just exploded. But because by this point I was taking litigation against the hospital on the advice of the hospital, because it was interesting actually how this came about. So Sam and I had been at home for about 6 weeks, and I got a letter from the hospital apologising for what had happened. They said, you know, what happened to you should not have happened, and we're investigating. This is not a normal occurrence. And that was
That in itself is highly unusual, because most of the time they will deny until forever. Yeah. If they can possibly deny, you know, that they were at fault, they will do so. So, you know, it for them to actually admit that.
And to initiate the conversation. I mean, like I say, my background is law. So I thought, well, hang on a minute. So I haven't actually been, because I just thought, oh, I've just been unlucky. I've had a rough time, you know, one of those things. But as soon as I got that letter, I thought, hang on a minute, is it this shouldn't have happened? What do you mean? It shouldn't have happened. And I was actually invited to meet the consultant who had stitched me up after the delivery. Now, this is always, when I tell people this bit of the story, if you like, they sort of struggle to get their head around it. So she invited me in to meet her, and off I went with Sam and Chris to meet this consultant. And she was extremely apologetic, you know, effusive apologies. Now, and I still maintain this to this day. I said to her, you know, I don't want your apology, because you saved my son's life. And yes, you've made a mistake, but this was a small mistake, really, that has had catastrophic consequences for me. But really, I want you to take away the fact that you've saved my child. And to me, people make mistakes. People are human. My brother's a vet, for example. And, you know, I know how easy it is for anybody to make mistakes. Not suggesting that he has made any, by the way. But, you know, he's a human being and she's a human being. And it was just really important to me that her life wasn't ruined as well as a result of this. Because, well, what would be the point in that? I remember her saying, oh, well, that, you know, this is extraordinarily magnanimous of you. And I said, well, I'm not really in life to be bitter about things, because it doesn't get you anywhere. I mean, it's one of the difficult things when you go through a traumatic birth is this is what people will say to you. Oh, but look, you've got a healthy baby. You should just be grateful. And that's not a correct thing for people to say, because that dismisses everything that you're going through.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, for me, I wanted her to know, though, that, you know, like some people said to me, well, I hope she's sacked. And I said, well, why? I wouldn't want her to be sacked. I would much rather she went back on the wards with this awareness of what's happened. She's not going to make the same mistake again. Like, why waste all of this training that she's had? And that's not something that would have made me happy.
But it's a misconception, isn't it, Jill, that actually, I mean, you know, I had a situation of how I got my stoma was that they just, again, same thing as when I had my daughter, you know, I knew something was terribly wrong and they were ignoring me and they didn't do the follow-up tests and, you know, it resulted in me having a perforated bowel.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really wanted a meeting with the doctor and they wouldn't let me have one. And, you know, what I wanted out of that meeting was for me to tell him and speak to me face to face about what his actions, the catastrophic result of his lack of action, should I say, in this situation, so that he could learn from it and not do it to somebody else. Because it's not just the physical recovery that you've got to go through when something goes wrong, it's the emotional and the psychological recovery. They're two things, and you know, of course they're interactive, they're not separate. That's why this podcast is about mind, body and spirit, because you can't separate the two. But they nevertheless, you have to recover on both levels, don't you? And I wanted to be able to tell him so that he could see for himself and understand. It's really important going forward as a doctor that you listen to your patients.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, this is the thing, isn't it? And so after that, you know, that letter, me going to see the doctor, the head of gynecology produced a report. And in this report, it said that mistakes were made, okay, that she'd identified a second degree tear, she'd done the stitches, and then she'd realised it was a third degree tear. And this all led to the fact that it was actually a fourth degree tear and a rectovaginal fistula. And we don't know, we still don't know if it was when the abscess burst, if that caused the rectovaginal fistula, or if the rectovaginal fistula was caused by the forceps. This is not something that they would know.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, I was lucky because the hospital were pretty open about the whole thing. And anyway, as time went on, they realised that because she'd done this double stitching, okay, so she'd gone from the second degree tear, taking the stitches down, to the third degree tear, she'd left no tissue around the sphincter. It was all too friable. You know, there wasn't enough good quality tissue in order to sew the sphincter hole back up properly.
And can I just interject there as well, for those people who are listening to this podcast who don't have this medical understanding, friable means it's like wafer-like, it's too thin, and it can disintegrate. So, you know, it's then no longer viable tissue, is it?
Yeah, that's right. So because of that, it meant I couldn't be repaired. Now, this was discovered through a variety of horrifically intrusive anal probe tests, which are just unbelievably mortifying to have to undergo. Mm. And I remember I found them so distressing because I used to think, oh my God, I'm lying here with a probe at my backside that I have to tense to try and hold to see what my pressure hold was like. I mean, can you even imagine what this is like for a 32-year-old woman? For anybody? You know, but I remember, you know, thinking this is so brutal, this is just so unfair that I'm going through all these horrific tests just because I had a baby. Like I say, it was eventually decided that I could not be repaired. So this meant that the colostomy was permanent. Now, this was a completely different ball game to what I'd initially thought all those months before, when I was on the ward, you know, and I was told this is temporary. And then you need to have a different mindset now, because this thing is for life. So before this point, I'd had a lot of problems with my bag, leaking all over the place. And every time I looked at my stoma, it was a reminder of everything that I'd gone through and how awful it was. And, you know, it was a real physical presence there.
Well, you can't get away from it, can you?
You can't. And I was really, really resentful. I was really angry. I kept a diary at the time, and you can see I got increasingly more and more angry as time went on. But then, you know, the stoma is going to be permanent. And I remember thinking then, right, well, hang on a minute. You can either continue feeling resentment and feeling anger and, you know, sort of allowing yourself to be reminded of this traumatic event every time you look at your stoma, which is kind of a luxury, if you like, if it's going to be temporary, or you're just going to have to get on with this. Because I thought, no, I don't want the dominant sort of emotion to be resentment and feeling bitter, because I don't want to look down every day and think, oh, look at this stupid stoma. This is a horrific reminder of all the trauma that I've been through. And I've just thought, no, do you know what? That's a really unhelpful attitude to have. That attitude will make you unhappy. And it will make you unhappy for the rest of your life. So you've got to snap out of that. And it really was, to me, as clear cut as that. You know, I had a word with myself. And
how far along after Sam was born are you talking about here?
So this was about 6 or 7 months later, when it was all, you know, it was all definite that it was going to be completely permanent. I'd been to see specialists all over the country. Eventually went down to see Dr. Robin Phillips down at St. Mark's Hospital in Harrow. Now, he's the top of his game. He's the number one. And I'd been given a couple of different diagnoses by some consultants. One consultant thought he could fix me. The other one said, no way. I went to another private doctor who said, no way. And I was beginning to get a bit confused. And I thought, you know what? I just need somebody who's at the top of their game to tell me what they think. And whatever they say, that is what I'm going to go along with. So I went to Robin Phillips and he said, yeah, this cannot be fixed. And I said, right, now that I know that, I can now get on with my life. He did fix the fistula. So after a year, he managed to fix the fistula, but the damage to my sphincter was just irreparable. So it was within that first year of having the stoma that I had this sort of, crossroads moment where I thought, you can either be miserable and bitter and resentful, or you can just accept it and make the best of it. And that's what I've done, really. Absolutely made the most of everything. I remember reading an article, can't remember where it was, but I remember reading an article by a fellow ostomate. As you'll know, this is what we call people who've got stomas, ostomates.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And they had had their bag as a result of Crohn's and colitis. So people who suffer from these awful conditions, you know, they're in a lot of pain for many years. And when they have their bag, it transforms their life. Okay, it takes away all that pain and it gives them something, it gives them opportunity. And this person had said in this article, I'm really grateful for what the bag has given me. You know, it's given me a life, it's given me freedom from pain and all that sort of thing. And it was like a little light bulb went off. And I thought, what has my bag given me? And I thought, well, if I didn't have my bag, I would be fecally incontinent. So if I went out the house, I would have to wear nappies or incontinence pads, or, you know, I don't know how badly incontinent I would be, but I would be incontinent. And obviously there would be the smell issue and I might just be housebound. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to go swimming. I wouldn't be able to go cycling. My life would really be over. But lucky me, I've got this bag. And I can go out to the shop and I can go walking and I can go swimming. And I thought, well, actually, I'm really lucky. And then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, you know, if this had happened to me in the 1950s, they didn't have the ostomy supplies that they've got now. Or if this had happened to me in the current age in a developing country, Sam and I could have died, or I would have to pay for all my ostomy supply. You know, it all just started coming together. And I just thought, yeah, I'm really lucky. You know, I've been given this opportunity to get on with my life. And it was all just sort of coming together more and more and more in a positive way, I suppose. And that's really how I've lived my life ever since. I mean, obviously we haven't yet touched on the fact that I lost my job as a result of this. And that's a whole different ball game. But for me, it was a conscious decision of changing my mindset.
And how did losing your job affect you?
Well, that is what gave me PTSD. That for me is and was and is remains the worst thing about this whole experience. Okay, so like we've already discussed, getting in the police, it's not just any old job. You're part of a family. You're part of a community. I found my tribe. You know, it's something I'd wanted to do for, you know, many, 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 many years. It took me 2 years to get in, and then poof, all gone, completely gone, totally disappeared. And because I was obviously on the sick, I had to go into the police station and have a meeting with HR and my inspector. And this was about, must have been when Sam was about 10 weeks old. So I remember getting into the police station and having my meeting, bumped into all the people from my team who wanted to obviously see the baby. And you know, it was I remember, you know, the radios went off and they were like calling up for jobs and running out the office. And I just thought, oh my God, like that, I am no longer that person. I'm no longer able to do that. Because by this point, 10 weeks down the line, there was pretty clear indications that this was not going to be an easy repair job of my sphincter. You know, I had an inkling, a pretty fair inkling, that it was going to be permanent by this point. And I remember leaving the police station and coming home, and I cried almost solidly for 3 days. I was just broken, completely broken. And it would get to the point where if I saw a police car, I would have to pull over and having a panic attack and having to try and control my breathing. And I remember being in traffic and there was a police car behind me, a total panic, because I was like, I can't get away from the police car, it's behind me. I didn't want this reminder of what I'd lost. It was too massive for me. And I used to say to people, oh, you know, I've got this real fear of being pulled over by the police. And then, you know, they would laugh. They said, well, that's stupid. Why would you get pulled over by the police? And I'd say, well, I don't know. Like, you know, what if I speed or something? Or I've got a light out and they want to check my documents, or they've got new police officers who want to try out giving tickets or something. And I used to say, but because I can't get in the police car, I can't get in the police car, and I don't think I can speak to a police officer. You know, it was really traumatic, and it was really strange to have this sort of thing going on in my head about something as seemingly innocuous as a police officer. I mean, even now I can't watch real life police programs, not just because I think they get it all wrong. you end up shouting at the television, but it's just too painful. I don't really have any of my friends left from the police. I made a conscious decision when we moved back up here that, right, that's it. I don't want to see what you're doing on Facebook. I don't want to see how you're getting on. I don't want to see you all still having your nights out. And it was just too much for me. I do have one friend who is my best friend from training school. I'm still in contact with. And that's really hard. I find it very tricky. She's now a detective. Well, she's nearly a detective sergeant, actually. She's just passed her exams. And she's living the career that I wanted. And, you know, as much as I celebrate all of her promotion and all of her success, it's very difficult. And when you're in the police, a bit like when you're in the forces, it takes over your life. It's your life, really. You go out drinking with other officers. You obviously talk about your job because it's such an important part of your life. And it takes away a lot of the conversation that I can have with one of my closest friends.
Well, it's a way of life, isn't it? And, you know, yeah. What I'm hearing you talk about in terms of your experiences is very typical of people who are resilient, is that, you know, when it's something that you can work through in a logical way and get your head round, then that's fine. But there's this massive, massive impact of another aspect of your life, because your life is not just being a wife or being a mother or whatever, it was having a career too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was my identity. You know, I was really proud to say to people, I'm a police officer. And yeah, people would go, oh right, you know, it's a respected job. Well, not all the time, but it's a respected job. And I felt important, actually. I felt important as a police officer. I had so much potential and so much to give, and it's taken a long time to get past this. And I think now, because I'm so successful, if you like, in doing other things and making the most of other opportunities that come my way that I wouldn't have had if I'd stayed in the police, I think only now, I mean, 9 years down the line, I'm starting to get a bit of closure over that. But I certainly, like, I don't like going back down to West Yorkshire. I think, again, I'm lucky. I was able to move back up to Northumberland. I was able to put that geographical space between me and where it all happened. So I hated going back down to West Yorkshire, because I would see my old beat, or I would think, oh, I remember when I went to a job there, or, oh, I remember coming back from a night shift and seeing this happen. And yeah, there's just too many memories. So I think I'm very lucky in that I can put that distance between me and what happened and me and the police, and I can sort of start again. So, you know, I think I'm lucky in that way.
That's the thing that I think is, you know, from sometimes I've had conversations and I changed from the surgical team I was under. I'm under a different consultant now. And one of the things that I find quite annoying about, you know, which my consultant's not like that at all. She's very understanding. She's got great patient skills, and it makes a massive difference. You know, is that to a surgeon, they're in their head, their job is to do the job, to do the surgery, to fix the problem, or, you know, or not. And, you know, to them, they don't see what that day-to-day living with a medical condition is like. For them, it's like a solution to a problem. So you had a problem, this is a solution. And when my bowel perforated, I had a problem, that was a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there isn't any of the thought that goes into, you know, the bigger picture for most of them. And this is what I campaign and what I work so hard for now in terms of, you know, getting people's voices out there, is the psychological aspect of life. Because, you know, without your psyche being in a healthy place, you're not doing anything. You know, you're mentioning things like that, for example. Yeah, absolutely, stoma supplies these days are incredible compared with what they used to be like 40 years ago. But even now, I mean, I use a flushable pouch, but, you know, even now there's so many people I speak to that have not even heard of it.
Yeah,
actually say to me, "Oh, is that new?" And I'm like, "No, it's been going 20 years."
Yeah.
So, you know, there's so many kind of aspects to this whole subject that it's not just a matter of fixing a problem, doing a surgery, and then sending that person back out into the world to get on with their life. Because sometimes you can't go back to who you were before.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I obviously lost my career, so I lost a well-paid job. And I lost my entire pension. And this was a biggie, because a police pension is a good pension. And, you know, we were left very suddenly in quite a precarious financial situation. Now, luckily, Chris was earning good money at the time, but it put enormous pressure on him. Enormous, because we lost my wage. You know, it meant he had to work away for longer. So he missed more of his baby, more of his child growing up. And he wasn't able to support me by being here. And that's difficult for him, you know, because they want to be here. But he was kind of forced to be away more because I didn't have a job. And I was just too poorly to work. So the impact on us as a family was just huge. And of course, then we had the whole postnatal depression thing going on as well, where I was really struggling to bond with Sam. I remember the first 7 months is what I call the potato period, when I say he might as well have been a potato. I cared for him and I looked after him and I made sure all of his needs were met. But I remember saying to my mum quite a few times, "But, you know, what if I hurt him?" And she would just look at me and she would say, "You're not going to hurt him." And I wasn't in my mind that I was going to, didn't have any plan, but I was very, very, very aware that I was a woman on the edge. I felt dangerous, actually, because I remember thinking, well, I'm just not in control of what's going on. I'm not in the right frame of mind to be in charge of a baby. And I don't have the normal feelings towards this baby that I think I should have. And I was actually really frightened of myself. But it's a very, very frightening situation to be in, because you don't feel like you can tell anybody. Because you think, if you say to someone, "Right, I feel like a woman on the edge, I feel really dangerous and I don't think I should be in charge of my baby. Well, it'll be gone. It'll be taken off you. That's it.
Well, it's a frightening place to be in. I mean, that's I didn't have those thoughts, but I did. I guess for me, when I had my daughter and I had my traumatic birth, it was the trauma caused a bout of PTSD. So, you know, the question then becomes like, what is actually the PTSD and what is postnatal depression? Because, you know, back in those days, women were neurotic. I mean, you know, this is 42 years ago. You know, women were just either postnatally depressed or they were neurotic. Nobody even touched or thought about the traumatic birth and the fact that there could be PTSD at play, which there obviously was. So, you know, for me, there was a massive strain in the sense that, you know, my husband was around a fair bit in Berlin, but he still nevertheless did go away. And I was on my own a lot. And there was no help. I mean, I didn't have family to help me. I had nobody. When he wasn't there, it was just me on my own with this child. And, you know, so for me, the way the trauma affected me, and I can relate to what you're saying, and I've heard, you're not the first person I've heard it from. And but for me, I was more terrified that something was going to happen to her. And, you know, every time I would pass by the pram, I would put my hand on her back and check that she was breathing. And, you know, that was that kind of terror, because we both nearly not made it. You know, that was the terror with me. So, you know, trauma hits women in very different ways, doesn't it? And I can't completely relate to it, because obviously it affected me very differently. But yeah, I can relate to how scary it must be to have feelings that you don't know how to deal with. And you know that they're probably not a good idea to tell everybody, you know? So what did you do? What did you do, Jill? How did you deal with that?
Well, it was very interesting, actually. So this was after 7 months, we came back to Northumberland. And we hadn't been up here for long, maybe a couple of weeks or something. And it's a bit like, you know, when you go on holiday, as soon as you go on holiday, you get ill, right? Because you've relaxed and your defences are down. And similarly for me, I came back to Northumberland and I think I was able to start relaxing. I had my family around. I had both, you know, my in-laws and my parents. All my old friends were still around here. I was actually able, I wasn't on such high alert constantly. And I remember distinctly looking down at Sam one day, and it was just like, it was like a little valve had popped in my heart. And I remember it. It was a physical sensation of something going all the way through my body. And I remember looking at him and thinking, oh,
You bonded in that moment.
Oh, and and I can record it as easily as it. And I think it was because I had the space to develop the relationship. I had the time to have that moment. I wasn't constantly thinking, oh God, you know, I'm completely on my own. And what, because what had happened, the reason I eventually decided after 7 months that I'd had enough, was because once again, I had to have emergency surgery. Chris was away. I couldn't find anyone to give me a lift to the hospital. I couldn't find anyone to look after Sam. My mum and dad were on holiday in Wales. Eventually I did find a friend who was absolutely amazing, Gareth. He, poor man, came to the hospital with us and ended up looking after Sam for hours while I was looked after. And that weekend I just thought, no, I've had enough. I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. And I'm going home. It was a really critical time for us. And I mean, after that, the relationship got stronger and stronger and stronger. And I always say to people that, you know, even if you don't bond with your baby at the beginning, when you do get that love, I think we've had to fight a little bit harder for it. And it's no less valid than other people's love for their child. But it was very difficult for Chris to hear me saying things like, God, I wish he'd never been born, you know, and I would only ever say awful things like that. But because he's so incredibly understanding, he was able to tell himself, she's saying this because she's poorly. She's saying this because she's not well. You know, she doesn't mean it, And, you know, at no point did he shout back or become angry or, you know, he would just take him off me.
And that's so, so important, isn't it? Because I know when my daughter was born and I came home, she was... Because she actually was overdue, even though they tried to pretend she wasn't, she would overfeed. And so I was producing gallons of milk. I mean, it was just running out of me. And so I was literally losing weight overnight every day. And my health visitor just said to me in the end, you know, you need to stop feeding because you're going to disappear, you know? So of course, you know, I started to get some strength back once I put her on the bottle, and obviously my husband could enjoy feeding her as well. And, you know, he brought his sergeant home one night, and I never forget it. We were sat in my lounge. I had boobs like melons. I remember Gary saying to me, I've never seen boobs that big anywhere, not even in a porn movie. And I said, we're not having that conversation, love, you know. And I just was so exhausted and tired and ill and trying to get over this major surgery and all the rest of it. And his sergeant, his colour sergeant, said to him, right, I'll give you a week off. And he looked at me after I'd been through all this trauma and he said, and in that time you better get your act together. Oh yeah. And I remember just feeling sick inside and wanting to hit the man with the nearest thing I could find and knock him out, you know. But I couldn't, because I was wife, and back then you didn't have a name, you weren't a person, you were wife of whoever. I was just wife of, so I had to be grateful. And in that time, putting her on the bottle and getting, you know, I started to get some of my physical energy back, and you know, so I, it was that feeling of just being traumatized and ill started to sort of lift a bit. But the interesting thing is, and my husband was fantastic, he was the eldest of five kids, so he really did help out once she was on the bottle and all the rest of it. And I got a bit of strength back by the time he actually went back to work. I can't say I got my act together, I hadn't quite done what I was told. But you know, I was feeling stronger by the time he went back to work a week later. And of course there was still no family and nobody to help me, so you know, it was quite tough being in another country. But for me, that special moment that you're talking about that took that 7 months to get, although I was paranoid that she was, something was going to happen to her and I was going to lose her, that was the barrier for me in not being able to let the love in, because I was so frightened. And it was a time where actually my husband was away, he'd gone away playing football, and I'd taken her out of the bath, and I'd swapped her routine around, because I used to bath her in the morning to start, you know, when she was yet tiny. And I swapped it around to an evening bath and sort of get her. And I'll never forget, I've still got this photo, and my heart just lifts every time I look at it. So she was 4 months old, and I put her on the nappy changing mat, dried her off, and she pushed herself up for the first time. She really pushed herself up, like right up, like she was doing a press up on this you know, nappy mat. And she grinned at me, and I just managed to catch a photo. And my heart just melted in that moment. And then there was a bit of sadness at the fact that obviously, you know, my husband had missed it, you know, as they do when they're away. But you know, you know, the love was always there, but you know, there is nothing quite the same, is there, that total bond comes with that moment, how you feel in that moment. You can't describe it. You've got to feel it, haven't you? You've got to be there.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you see, I don't know, I think it must just be my attitude to things, but I think, well, I think I'm really lucky to have that moment to remember it. I don't know, I feel like I really had to fight to get it, and I just feel grateful to have had such a distinct moment.
Well, let's go on though, you know, let's go on and move on to this really majorly positive stuff that you're doing. I just shiver even thinking about what you're doing at the moment. So you are raising money for charity at the moment, aren't you?
I am, yes. Well, I'm raising money for the Birth Trauma Association, who I've raised money for in the past. I did a half Ironman triathlon for them in 2017. And I decided in the summer this year, on the summer solstice, that I was going to get my bikini on and my bag out for the first time. I have no idea why I decided to do it then, but I did. And I went off with my swimming friends, because I am an open water swimmer. I do some open water swimming. And off we went to see in the summer solstice, bag out, bikini on. And it was a really sort of euphoric moment for me. It was quite liberating, actually. And anyway, as time went on, I decided a few weeks later that I was going to start a blog. So this is all interlinked. So I set up my blog in July of this year. It's called Stoma Chameleon. So it's all about what people can do with stomas, but also it's about how I think people are like chameleons. We can adapt. We can adapt to whatever's going on in our life, to not necessarily to fit in, but whatever's happening in your life, you can adapt and you can just get on with it, really. So I set it up as a positive site. It's all meant to be positive. What we can achieve after trauma, what you can achieve with a stoma. But it's also relevant to anyone's life, because everyone goes through some sort of upheaval in their life that they don't expect. So it's all about how you can be resilient and how a positive attitude can get you through things. And of course, as we know, we are undergoing a global pandemic, and everything, everywhere you look, it's miserable, 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 negativity everywhere. So that's part of the reason that I just suddenly thought in July, right, I am going to put some positivity out there. So I set up my website, and after my euphoric bikini moment on the summer solstice, I decided I would raise money for the Birth Trauma Association and raise awareness of them through my blog. So I decided that I would wear only a bikini, no gloves, no socks, no neoprene whatsoever for all swims or dips between the 1st of October and the 1st of May next year.
I'm just shivering listening to you, Jill. I'm shivering here because I'm allergic to cold. I tell you, I can't, you know, to me, I swim in the sea if it's the Caribbean, you know, because yeah. I don't.
Well, you wouldn't catch me in there, you see. Oh, no, because there's sharks in there. So I'm quite happy with that. But I did a really cold one a couple of days ago. It was 3.7 and that was really cold. But the reason I'm doing it till May, some people might not be familiar with the temperatures in our water over here, and the coldest time in the sea is actually April and May, March, April, May. That's when it's coldest. It's cooling down from now on. It gets colder and colder and colder, and then yeah. It gets to May and it starts to warm up a bit. So that's why I'm actually doing it until then, because I want to really challenge
get cold. Through. You just want to get cold, don't you, really? Yeah. You just want to be, you know, brave in the cold in a bikini.
Absolutely. So I've got my sign out that explains why I'm wearing a bikini. And it says on there, why am I wearing a bikini in the water? And it, you know, just says, my name is Jill. I've got a stoma as a result of a traumatic birth. I'm doing this to raise money for the Birth Trauma Association, but also to raise awareness of stomas, and also just to show people that we can do anything. And I really believe that. I really believe that people are capable of so much more than they think. I mean, I've done things like skydiving. I am terrified of flying. I mean, I'm one of these embarrassing people that sniffle and weep all the way through the flight, and is alert to any noise and constantly says, what's that? Well, you know, but I did a skydive, and I've started scuba diving, and just like overcoming fears is really empowering, I think.
It definitely is, and I've kind of had the opposite journey to you, in the sense that when I got my stoma, I tried to, because the whole belly community was starting to be quite out there back then. I got mine into at the very, very end of 2013, so it's nearly 7 years ago, and I think, you know, I wanted to try and fit in. And I used to blog for a company called SecuraCare. I did talks for them as well, and that's who I partnered with to do the fitness video. And, you know, it was along that journey, as I was trying to adjust, that I got to a point where I actually realized that I was trying to fit into a community I didn't want to belong to. And, you know, I think when it comes to, I mean, obviously being a trained therapist in, you know, in a former life, you know, that, you know, I do believe that it's very important that as we heal from anything, whether it's physical or emotional, we do it in our own way, in our own time, and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I came to this realization, and I actually wrote a final blog not that long ago, actually, because I've met some incredible people along the way. And, you know, I'm here talking to you. I'm doing different things with my life now. And same as you, I do have that resilience. But I've been trying to make peace with something that I couldn't make peace with, and, you know, try to fit into a community and go out there and do all these things. And then I realized, actually, I want my stoma to be a bit more private than this. So I quite enjoy talking to people that don't know I've got one.
It's interesting you say that, because I accepted my bag pretty early on when I realised it was permanent. And it was a conscious decision. I'm going to accept this and it's going to be fine. And I have never, ever, ever felt the need to get my bag out in public. It's just, you know, not really me, not what I do. The reason I did it in July is I just wanted to see if I could, and I did, and it was fine. But then I thought, you know, it's actually quite attention grabbing, isn't it? So this is why I'm doing my bikini thing, getting my bag out, and people do look, and it does raise a conversation. And this is all fine. I'm quite happy to do this to raise awareness and get attention. But when it gets to May, my bag will be going back underneath my clothes. I think there's quite a lot of pressure on people to feel like they have to get their bag out to show that they've accepted it. Well, that's not the case. Everyone accepts it. Things totally differently, and just because you don't want to get your bag out in public does not mean that you've accepted it any less. And I just feel like there's a little bit of a pressure to get your bag out.
Totally agree. And I did try. I wanted to fit in, and I wanted to be okay with it. And I've come to a point, and mine is a little bit different to yours, because I am a candidate for reversal surgery. Mm-hmm. It, you know, to me, was when I was told I was going to have a stoma, it was going to be, oh, we're just going to give you a temporary bag for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Really? You know, and actually, because of the negligence, and because of how, I mean, you know, if you read my notes from the time, it's like a horror story, and you've just described your own horror story, you know. And when you have that's something else to get over. And I'm just too terrified of the idea of going back into having surgery to even contemplate it. So that's the thing I'm trying to get in my head around at the moment, you know. Being able to accept being stuck with something that I never wanted, that I should be able to get rid of. And that's a very different thing to having to accept something that you can't get rid of, isn't it? You know, so, you know, and getting to that point of really accepting, actually, this is not okay. And I'm okay with saying that this is unwelcome and it shouldn't have happened. And that that's the thing I need to make my peace with.
Yeah.
I think it's great when all these people do what you're doing. Oh my goodness, I would come and watch. But and having been somebody that lived by the sea when I was a kid, I do know that the water is now going to get colder, because I lived by the sea for like 4 years. So it's going to be in the spring that it's going to be at the coldest. So what we'll do is on when this goes onto YouTube, we will put a link to so the people can find you and donate. Oh, I think it's a wonderful thing that you're doing. But as we're kind of starting to get to the end of this conversation, what I want you also to tell all the listeners is you've got something a bit bigger than just dipping plans, haven't you? What have you got planned next?
Well, I do like a challenge, and I have decided, it was actually a conversation I had with another girl called Kaylee. Now, she's another mum who's got a stoma as a result of childbirth injuries. She's only had hers for 2 months, so she's a lot earlier on in her journey. Now, Kaylee used to be a competitive swimmer, and she's seen me doing my bikini thing. And she got in touch and said, "Oh, so pleased. I didn't think that I would ever be able to swim again. And, you know, thank you for sort of showcasing it, if you like." Anyway, a couple of weeks ago, she messaged me and said, "I was just wondering, have you ever thought about swimming the channel?" And I mean, that's all I need someone to say. And I thought, well, actually, I have, but I'm terrified of the ocean. I'm terrified of swimming in the dark. Cannot get in the sea on my own. I'll be really frightened of that. But, you know, as soon as I've got this little idea in my head, yeah, so that's what I'm doing. In 2023, I've signed up to swim the channel solo. I'm doing it to raise money again for the Birth Trauma Association for Colostomy UK, but also really, really importantly for a charity called Jacob's Well Appeal. And they send, amongst other things that they do, they send ostomy supplies out to children living in deprived countries, because in, for example, places like Moldova or the Philippines, children are using crisp packets, tin cans, plastic bags. A lot of the children die during the surgery as well because they just don't have the proper healthcare. So that's what I'm raising money for. And that's why I'm doing it. So, yeah.
Are you saying is that you're going to be splitting it between these three charities?
Yes.
Fabulous.
Yeah. I haven't decided what way, like who's going to get how much or how it's going to go. But, yeah, so these three charities. I've got my boat organised, Stuart Gleeson of Sea Leopard. Kaylee's going to be on my crew. I've got my physio. I've got my nutritionist. Got the whole team behind me, and so I'm getting started. I'm really excited about this, actually. I mean, this is a massive challenge for me. So, I mean, swimming 21 miles on my own, potentially through the night. I mean, I get little hysterical laughters, little giggles when I think of the enormity of it all. But you know what? Nothing ventured, nothing gained. I think I'll be the first person with a stoma to swim the channel. So
I have having had a couple of conversations with you now, Jill, I have absolutely every faith that you're going to pull this one off. I think you're going to do what you're doing now, and you'll do it at the coldest time. You'll go through the whole thing because you have got that determination, which is fabulous to hear. It really is. I think this conversation is going to inspire a lot of people, and we will keep in touch with you. And we will definitely have another conversation. I would like to do when 2023 comes around.
Sounds like a plan. Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much for being on Alternate Realities today. It's been absolutely wonderful. It really has been wonderful.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation, actually. Yeah, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me on.
That concludes episode 8 of Alternate Realities. A big thank you to Jill for being our guest today. She is certainly one massively inspiring woman with all the things that she is doing with her life now and the things that she's got planned for the future. And I have absolutely no doubt that she will completely smash that channel swim. We wish her all the very best with that. Birth trauma is something that thankfully is being spoken about more these days, and with that there will be a lot more help out there for women who experience such a terrible time at what should be just a beautiful and joyous experience. I know that when I had my first child almost 43 years ago now, it was something that really was not talked about, and if a woman had any problems following the birth of her child, it was almost like there was something wrong with her if she couldn't cope in any way with what had happened to her. And yet, as you have heard today, there was just two experiences of two women that had a conversation today that were so very, very different and yet equally traumatic. We certainly don't put together the idea of having a colostomy with having a baby, and yet sometimes that is actually what happens. There are so many things that can go right and so many things that can go wrong when we actually go down that path of motherhood. We thank Jill so much for sharing her story today. It, I hope, will help a lot of ladies out there that may be suffering. Episode 9 will be with you shortly, when we will be bringing you another inspirational story to share. Thank you for listening.